It's the very, very first episode of the Coin Talk Fake Internet Money Book Club. We are talking about Safedin Ammous's The Bitcoin Standard. I hope you have already picked it up. If not, grab it now. You can always catch up. Wow, I'm just dropping screws over here. I really enjoyed the book. I really enjoyed the conversation I had with Jay about it. We talked mostly about chapters 1 through 3. So if you're going to get it and tune in next week, we'll be talking about chapters 4 to 7, but it's all loose, just ideas that come up. It's kind of fun to step outside of the weekly crypto news cycle and just talk about some of the ideas behind all of this. Our partner in all of this, Medium. Medium makes it easy to read about crypto. They've got a landing page for it, me.dm/crypto. We've got our own page. That's at medium.com/cointalk. It's got transcripts of every episode. So if you're trying to play catch up, that's a great way to go through it quickly. If you'd like to get in touch, perhaps with questions about the book for future episodes, send us an email, hi@cointalk.show. Okay, here's the show.
This episode of Coin Talk was taped Wednesday, May 9th at 4 p.m. Eastern Standard Time. The Bitcoin price index was $9,273.
Jay,
what's up?
Did you read the Bitcoin Standard?
I did. I mean, it actually was a little bit of an effort, and I had to scrap it together from different parts of the internet, but I believe that I got all the pages together.
After we announced this, I assumed that you would purchase the book, but instead I understand you're working from like a PDF you got off of Reddit.
Not entirely. to tell our future guest, the author of the book, I attempted to buy it on Kindle, and it had even a price on Kindle that I could order it on.
Yeah.
And so I was going to pay it, but it was only in the sample. So it was like the prologue, the introduction, and the first chapter.
That's what it shows before you pay, I think.
Well, I went back and I tried to actually pay.
Oh, yeah.
And then I was like, oh, no, I'm in trouble. And then I did what I do when I can't get an NBA game to stream. So I went on like basically Bitcoin book streaming, like Reddit.
Subreddit. Last week we had Art Kang. This week, Bootlegger Kang.
Yeah, look, it's one of these things where, you and I are both in our, I would say, late 30s.
Yeah.
And
got Limeshare Kang in that.
Yeah,
house.
And I think that the one sort of weird artifact of our exact age is that we probably should just pay for things in their full way, but like we just try and hack them to save like 14 cents or something like that.
Okay.
Anyway, the point being, I did read it.
Well, before we get going, the point being, the book is only $10 in print on Amazon. If you haven't picked it up, pick it up. This is kind of our like introduction to the book. So we're only going to do the first couple chapters. You're going to be able to catch up if you want to catch up. And we're just going to start talking about things that we're thinking about as we read this book. Jay, what'd you think?
I thought it was a very interesting and provocative argument for Bitcoin. Being a very impressionable man, right?
Yeah.
I found myself at times scratching my head and saying, maybe I should just become a full-on Bitcoin maximalist.
Yeah, I mean, in some ways, the vision doesn't seem that crazy once you sort of like start seeing the big leaps that before.
Oh, look, I think what he has presented us is a revision of the white paper. So for a lot of people who got into Bitcoin who weren't there from the very beginning, we have a shorthand of these sorts of ideas of what money is, how Bitcoin fits into the evolution of money. But it's never really fully articulated for any of us. And I think that we sort of have a piecemeal understanding of it. And what this book does over the first 3 chapters, and which I actually appreciated, even though there are parts, obviously, that I think anybody would, you know, I'm sure that Safedin wants people to disagree with it. There are parts I disagreed with, but it was very nice to see the whole thing laid out.
It's interesting that you brought up the white paper there. That wasn't what I thought about it in relation to the white paper. My thought when I was reading this, and basically like the second chapter, which is monetary metals, kind of goes through all of these previous incarnations of how we've created currency from scratch here on Earth. And I was like, oh, this is definitely the stuff that Satoshi was interested in when he made Bitcoin.
Yeah.
I've always thought of Satoshi as a cryptographer and a person interested in computer science. And it made me think of Satoshi in a more humanities economics-based light as someone who had really studied this human problem of currency as probably a big part of at least his passion in the world.
Yeah, and I think that some of the earlier people who were interested in this space, whether it be like Szabo or really anybody who was working on these currency projects before, like that was also part of their interest. And I think that the 2008 crash really pushed a lot of those ideas even further when the government just started printing money. But let's get that to that a little bit later.
Sure.
So let's start with the introduction, who is written by the man who has blocked me on Twitter, who seems to come up every single time in our episodes, Nassim Taleb. And he wrote the introduction.
And I would like him, I'm going to try and get him to come on the show.
Really?
I'd love to have him on the show.
I would too.
He's like, I think he hates journalists, so I'd like to see him like hates go journalists. After you a little bit. Additionally, one of the things that I learned in trying to get in touch with Safedin Ammous, that Taleb was actually influential in him getting this book published. I mean, he's not a quote-unquote writer by trade. He is an economist and a researcher. Although I find his writing very, like, crisp.
Yeah, it was. I actually thought it was very readable.
Yeah.
And that the argument was laid out very clearly in a way that I actually appreciated, because I expected, given Safedin's, you know, somewhat, I think, purposefully heightened and somewhat florid Twitter account, that this would be like a really like over the top defense of Bitcoin, but it's not. It is rational.
No, it's even keeled. I actually find it like interesting that you have referred to it a couple times as an argument for Bitcoin. It's so smooth that to me, a lot of it reads like, and this is what happened through history. And of course, the logical, the logical place we'd end up with. It's almost like the way that Marx describes the end state of like socialism, not as, hey, this would be a good idea, we should fight for it, but as like, this is a historical inevitability.
Yeah, Marx is a very interesting example to use when talking about an anarcho-capitalist.
Yes.
But yes, the rhetorical, I do think the rhetorical techniques are similar. So Taleb writes the introduction. I will say, and I think you would agree, he writes a very short introduction.
It's kind of like an extended blurb.
Yeah, but there was one part of it that was, rational markets do not require any individual trader to be rational. In fact, they work well under zero intelligence. A zero intelligence crowd under the right design works better than a Soviet-style management comprised of maximally intelligent human beings. And so what he's making an argument for is essentially that like markets are going to stabilize over time, and that they're going to have their own logic to them, and that they don't need actors within the market. They just need to exist. And that's what his argument for Bitcoin is.
The way that viewpoint works is that Bitcoin is just by its very creation, by the Satoshi moment, like on some like inexorable like roller coaster ride towards ubiquity. Although I think it's interesting that Taleb, and he's made this point in other writing that I've read of his, it does not say like Bitcoin is necessarily going to succeed or not succeed. He's like, the cryptocurrency itself, the cat is out of the bag. And even if this fails, it can be recreated now. The idea can never go away.
That is the real question, I think, that is sort of facing crypto right now. And it's something that we've talked about before, but it is really, I mean, there's just news that is coming out that we'll discuss later in the show, but it's about sort of the high concentration of Bitcoin in a very small number of people's hands. It makes you wonder if that is sustainable, if that will sort of tank the idea eventually. But I don't think that...
Really? See, I thought that argument, like when you look at Bitcoin compared to all the other currencies, it's like pretty spread out.
No, well, the other cryptocurrencies,
yes.
But not like world currencies.
Oh, not world currencies.
Yeah, but
yes.
Not legitimate
currencies.
That's a separate argument, but I do think that the question of whether or not it will be Bitcoin is one that should be seriously asked right now. And I think he is asking that same question as well. The person who is not asking that question is Safedin Ammous, right? And so this book starts with a very bare bones and very sort of logical progression of an explanation of money. Did you know all this stuff about money?
I would say I knew like 50% of it, but I didn't know it.
At the start of money, then he's Safedin sort of starts with this idea of bartering, right?
Yeah.
That the barter system is one that still exists today, and it is by far the most logical way to exchange something, which is like, you know, you say, I'll give you these fish, and you give me, let's say, those apples, right? And that's the barter that you do. And he explains that the problem is that when you go from saying, like, I will give you these fish, you give me a house, right? Like, how do you make that exchange? Like, obviously, there are many problems with it because you can't, how many fish do you need for a house?
Yes.
You know, do you give the fish at the beginning or do you give it at the end when all the fish are dead? You know, like, how do you deal with a perishable good versus like an actual thing? And how do you make that transaction over time? So that's a very logical thing. I think that's at the core of all economics. And well, I think that's where he starts.
And in the 21st century, there's such a great diversity of goods that there's such an asymmetry of what one person would have that the other person would need. And then that working the other direction kind of reminds me of, you ever like buy stuff on Craigslist?
Not as much as you do. You seem to have bought everything in your life on Craigslist at some point. So not quite like you. So why don't you explain Craigslist?
So sometimes I'll like be trying to buy like a synthesizer or something. And they're like, also we'll consider like bartering and trades. What is the chances that I have something of equal value that this person wants with like no guide whatsoever? That just seems like a pretty far-fetched assumption to make about the world. So it kind of feels like almost immediately you start needing an intermediary if you're going to be able to do almost any kind of business.
Yeah, and that's his argument, is that the history of exchanges starts with bartering, and then you immediately run into these problems when it's not just like hunter-gatherers trading things with one another, and they need to actually trade goods. So you need something that stands in for some sort of promise, right? Which is saying, like, this is worth this. This is a store of exchange, or this is a store of value. And that there's a logical progression that goes through a lot of different things. Shells, for example, he talks about a lot. They're like seashells that were used.
Those rocks with the hole in the middle of them.
Yeah, yeah. And then all these types of money have problems with them. So, for example, wampum. Did you know what wampum was before?
I was not familiar what wampum was.
Okay, so wampum was a Native American tribe's version of currency, and it was shells, right?
Yeah,
and
seashells.
Seashells. And at some point, some explorers, I think, came and like they sort of flooded the market with wampum, and then the wampum became devalued.
Yeah.
And he says that that's bad for any number of reasons. Like, did you understand the reasons why he was saying that was bad?
Well, I mean, he gives all of these historical examples that seem like they're divergent, but then end in the same place, which is technology catches up. And so even when people like try to fight that devaluation, usually like when technology catches up and people can figure out how to make whatever it is you're using at money, that thing is fucked.
Yeah. So that's one of the principles that I think he's laying out here, which is that money needs to kind of be scarce, right?
Yes.
The resource needs to be scarce. It needs to be very unique in the sense that you can't just go get more wampum out of like the wampum hole that nobody has discovered and then flood the market with new wampum.
The end state of all of this is that we resolve on these metal currencies. There's been many metal currencies, but gold, silver, bronze are like the biggest ones in history that require a certain amount of labor to extract the metal. And it's hard enough that the market cannot be flooded. And if it is flooded, or if you do mine more, it's not enough so that it undermines the value of the stuff.
Yeah, there's no sea captain coming in with like a whole bunch of gold.
Right. I mean, those are sort of the end state of all these ideas, or the like pre-fiat money end state of all of these. It's like we talk about like FUD and what the like greatest existential threats to like Bitcoin system is. The greatest existential threat to the gold system was like alchemy, basically.
Yeah.
If someone had figured out alchemy, it would have been like all over.
Yeah, well, if you could turn regular, that's probably why alchemy was such a good racket for so long.
That's what I'm saying.
So Saviden goes on to outline his case then for why Bitcoin, given all of these things that we know about money, is the best version of money that there ever has been, right? And that what used to be the gold standard, which is, look, the problems with gold is that it's hard to divide up. So like if I bring out a nugget of gold for your synthesizer, I haggle you down to
like that's a big nug, man.
Yeah, I haggle you down to like half an ounce of gold for your synthesizer. It's very difficult for me to like sit there and like hack off half an ounce and give it to you.
Sure.
And so that's why paper money exists, because it's more divisible and it is based on gold. So I think when the United States first dollar was printed, like an ounce of gold was $20 or something like that. He mentioned it in his book.
I mean, I didn't realize that the gold standard wasn't established until like, I think like the late 1800s.
Sure.
So like even the end state of gold is like a last 200 years kind of thing. Like we're in a pretty like young state of money.
For the type of money that we have right now?
Yeah, fiat money. Like money that originally represented gold in like Fort Knox and then was printed way more of than there is gold in Fort Knox.
Yeah, and I would argue that in the United States that we had another revolution in money beyond the switch over to fiat currency, which started in probably the 80s when Wall Street was just basically printing money and money stopped meaning anything. And then 2008, obviously, where people's relationship with all this fiat currency and Wall Street radically changed. And now we're in some sort of flux period. And so I think that within that continuum, it does make sense that something would change. It's not like we're dealing with something that's deeply rooted and has thousands of years of history that seems pretty intractable. And I think that of all the arguments he makes, at least at the beginning of this book, is the most convincing to me, which is that if you zoom out a little bit, the idea that this would switch over does actually makes sense. It's not like human nature or anything like that to have a fiat currency that used to be pegged off the gold standard and is no longer.
He also makes a pretty strong argument, at least to me, that this problem of how do you keep money and hold its value over time? Any solution to that problem is in some ways a gamble, whether it's holding fiat currency, buying commodities, whatever you're doing, you're in some ways gambling on some future state. And as he goes through all of these historical examples of different kinds of money, eventually the long-term value of just holding money keeps going down and people are driven to speculate on wilder and wilder things rather than just holding their money.
Yeah.
Do you mind if I read a quick quote from him?
Yeah, no, please.
It should be of interest to modern Keynesian economists as well as to the present generation of investors that although the emperors of Rome frantically tried to manage their economies, he's talking about these like early Roman gold coins that the emperor kept clipping bits off of. They only succeeded in making matters worse. Price and wage controls and leaguer tender laws were passed, but it was like trying to hold back the tides. Rioting, corruption, lawlessness, and mindless mania for speculation and gambling engulfed the empire like a plague. With money so unreliable and debased, speculation in commodities became far more attractive than producing them. So he's kind of talking about this like great eternal human cycle of people like growing dissatisfied with the current money or rightly believing that the current money is not going to maintain its value and speculating on some sort of a future, whether it's like Bitcoin or like
what you described right there in that passage seems very similar to where we are right now.
Absolutely.
Everything is wild speculation and, you know, people's idea of store of value is no longer in the country itself, but or in civic or government institutions, but instead are in tech companies. When you do that, you are engaging in wild speculation. You know, like if you have all your money invested in Amazon or Apple or something like that, that's wild speculation by anyone's standards.
Well, I would also argue that what you're seeing people doing across a variety of investment activities over the last 20 years is betting on the future. If you bought Apple when it IPO'd in 1980, you were betting on the future. If you bought Apple stock when the iPhone came out, you were betting on the future. If you're buying Tesla right now against like the most massive market shorting in history, you're betting on a specific future. And if you're buying cryptos now, you're betting on a specific future. So people have shown a wild appetite to gamble speculatively on what the future will be like.
Yeah, and that doesn't even count things like real estate and everything.
Oh, sure.
Yeah. So like, I mean, we do live, I think, and maybe, you know, I'm sure some economists will, you know, tweet at us and say that we're wrong, but it feels to me at least that and maybe it is.
We encourage that, by the way.
Maybe it's just you and me being also very speculative. People with gambling problems.
It's a human impulse. That's what he's saying. People felt this way during the Roman Empire.
Yeah.
Like, it's nothing new.
And part of that, I think, does have to do with the fact that our faith in this currency and in the stability of the economy. For example, like it used to be that people would work for a company and that they would be paid a salary, but they would also be paid in the company stock, and it would never occur to them to trade that stock for something else, you know, that they could count on a certain stable life of comfort. And that's not where we are right now. You know, we have people like look what the people who got really rich off Bitcoin or Ethereum, you know, like they're the people that people look up to now. It's not people who work 20 years anywhere.
I was struck. I mean, he gives some great historical examples, but once you start racking your mind, you can keep coming up with different ways that we've created weird markets that people then speculated on. And sometimes they were like dead ends, and sometimes they led to like giant economies. I was reading about Michael Cohen and his taxi medallions.
Yeah.
I didn't know what the origin of the New York City taxi medallion is.
Oh my God, I know all about this. But
so it's during the Great Depression in New York City, almost everyone was out of work and lots of people had cars. So people would just start driving around trying to pick people up for like a little bit of money to drive them somewhere. And eventually there was like huge traffic.
Yeah.
People were like, we got to regulate this. There's too many cars in the road. So they're like, all right, we're only going to grant a certain number of taxi medallions. What struck me about this medallion story was how quickly it went from being like this regulation of basically like unemployed people trying to make money on the side to people were like massively speculating and accumulating taxi medallions. Cut to 2009, where you have Michael Cohen, Trump's attorney, buying tons of taxi medallions, then using those as collateral to buy even more taxi medallions and being massively leveraged in taxi medallions during the period when Uber rose and the taxi medallions cratered. He was like doubling down long on taxi medallions in debt. That is the most wrecked bet I have ever heard.
It is actually, I cannot think of a worse version. Like if you were going to be, how would you get most wrecked? And be like, listen, you just get up to your nose leveraged in taxi medallions.
Yeah.
There was a period of my time, Aaron Lammer, where I considered speculating on taxi medallions. I don't know if I could short taxi medallions.
I would.
I don't know if this shocks you or not, but I have a friend who is a city planner. He just finished his PhD, and his specialty is transit. And so when the green cabs came out, do you remember that? They came out before
Eco-taxis.
Uber. No, not green. Oh. No, in Brooklyn.
Yeah, they were like the borough cabs.
Yeah, they're green cabs that cannot make pickups in Manhattan.
And do you need a medallion for those?
Yeah.
But a different medallion.
The medallions were way cheaper. So,
it was like an ICO for like a second not quite as good medallion.
Exactly. A taxi medallion at the time for Manhattan, a yellow taxi medallion, cost over $1 million, right? So obviously that is out of my league. But
not anymore.
First of all, don't.
No, I'm saying the medallions are like.
Oh, yeah. They're not $1 million.
No, they're not $1 million. They're like, I think you get them like under 500 now.
Yeah. So
that's your ultimate contrarian move if you start aggregating rock bottom taxi.
I've thought about that too. At the time, I think we could have bought a taxi medallion for $14,000 for the green cabs. And the way that I looked at it, and this must have been like, I don't remember what year it was, but it was right before Uber. And thank God I didn't do it. But obviously Brooklyn was growing rapidly at that time in terms of like having more wealth come into that area. And I was like, this green taxi medallion is such a bargain right now. And so
I see your investment hypothesis.
I considered buying some.
Hey, I think green cab medallion could be worth more than Manhattan medallion after
the flippening. I did not think that. Yeah, the taxi medallion fork. I was buying up all the BCH.
Yeah. It would be crazy if it like they were really cheap medallions. Like you're like, yo, I've got some bargain basement Newburgh, New York medallion, $7.
People do that though. It is on an open market like that. And so I think that what that does prove essentially is that the second that you open any type of market like this, then you have wild speculation that happens almost immediately by people who have a giant, giant stomach for that type of speculation. As a person who has basically lived his entire life doing that type of wild speculation, I was not immune to the promise of green taxi medallions, and thank God I did not do it.
Yeah.
That would have been a disaster.
What are they worth now? They're worth less than $14,000 now?
I think they're pretty hard to like even...
Oh, like there's just no volume on the
There's
leg.
No volume. There's no volume on the green. The candles are flat.
Oh, wow, man.
Anyway, so that why were we talking about this?
Michael Cohen got wrecked.
Yeah, that is such wreckage.
I mean, it's a similar like dynamic of what would happen if a large number of people, and I don't know if the people have done this, took out loans to buy Bitcoin.
Yeah.
Which
yeah.
was happening during the like height of the mania.
Yeah, like around 14,000.
I think we haven't like heard about that for a while, thank God. If that can get rooted out of the system, that would be a good idea.
The problem with the taxi medallion thing compared to Bitcoin, though, is that Bitcoin might go back up to $25,000 or $20,000 this year.
Yeah.
The taxi medallion is never going back up to $1 million.
Well, if you, the only way to bet on like that long on the taxi medallions would be betting that New York City is going to ban Uber.
Yeah.
Ban all ride hailing apps, which I could have seen as a bet you maybe would have made in 2012. That is a tough call right now.
Off. But if you had an inside track onto New York City's going to ban Uber, that is a great next Bloomberg business story. This man had an...
Whereas if you had stayed in the like Austin taxi market, which doesn't have Uber, maybe those medallions have done better over this period.
No, I think they have. And that was a lot of the argument about regulating Uber, was that all these people who owned medallions were getting completely wrecked, you know?
Well, and tell me if I'm wrong. I mean, as long as we're this deep into taxi medallions, I think we should just go whole
episode. Should we just start a taxi medallion podcast?
Yeah, taxi medallion cast. But it seems like the like guys like Michael Cohen, who were deep leveraged in the taxi medallion game, liked being in that business because, as far as I understand, when you have a medallion, a driver goes, drives a shift, and gives you $100.
Yeah.
And I would guess that that historically has been a cash payment.
It was for years the best investment that you could have because the value only went up, right? New York City's, they cap it, right? So you at some point, there can't be more.
Yeah.
The Taxi Licensing Commission has to put out more. They wouldn't, you know, because they were controlled by all these people who were leveraged to the eyeballs on it. So they were scarce. Population in New York City kept going up. So, you know, obviously these rides are in high demand. And if you own five of them, then you have two things. Yeah, right. You have the people who you rent the medallion to who are paying you
cash, which makes you a very friendly person to the mafia.
All the time. And it keeps, and the value keeps going up. And so it's like it's like owning an apartment in a neighborhood that where the price can only go up and getting rent without having to pay any sort of maintenance fees or anything like that. I mean, it was an amazing investment for years.
I believe Safedin Amous is arguing that Bitcoin is that investment right now.
Wait, so you can have someone drive your Bitcoin around?
No, it's all of those qualities that you just described.
Yes, because it's deflationary.
Because it's deflationary. And that's ultimately, he's like, we've been experimenting with all of these currencies and here's what's gone wrong. All of these things lead up to this point in history. And gold mining has been pretty successful. They've been able to control it, but Bitcoin is one step further. There's not any more. There's not the same gold. I think they say there's 2% added to the world supply every year. Like, there's 21 million Bitcoin. That's it. You know, it's a taxi medallion.
So maybe this is a question that we should ask.
Except there's no Uber in this universe.
Well, there is Ubers. There's like 5,000 Ubers that are trying to take down Bitcoin. That's the biggest problem. Ethereum is fucking Uber, man. You know, and like Ripple is Juno. There is competition. So, but I think he would acknowledge that.
I think he would too.
The second part of the taxi medallion example, which I actually think is pretty apt. I'm glad that you brought it up. Is that the problem with the taxi medallion was it was not that like an immigrant family from Bangladesh would scrape together and like, you know, use all their family network to pool together to buy a taxi medallion. That did happen. It was very rare.
Yeah.
It's that this whole thing got, you know, swamped up by a small number of people who were either prospecting for it or were straight up mafia, you know?
Or in the case of Michael Cohen, we're like, Jewish attorney mafia.
Yeah. Exactly. So that's the problem with a deflationary currency or any sort of deflationary. And I do think that, you know, you could say that tax medallions are a currency.
Yeah.
Is that once it's fucked, it's very hard to unfuck it.
Yes.
Right.
And I think that's the risk of Bitcoin, which is you're like, this is great. It's a taxi medallion. Also, if an Uber comes out, this could be worth almost nothing.
Yeah, exactly. And also, now that I have these medallions and I'm making money off of it, nobody else can have medallions because I also control the guy who prints more medallions, and I've told him that he cannot print any more medallions. So, you know, a few weeks ago, we talked about Jim Surowiecki's article that he wrote in MIT Technology Review. And one of the things that he said was that the reason why fiat currency is good is because you can unfuck things, you know, like you can figure out how to solve massive problems that happen.
You can engineer an economy.
Yes.
And Bitcoin is not an engineered economy.
Yes. Like basically Bitcoin right now is taxi medallions at the height of Michael Cohen fucking leveraging himself. borrowing money to buy more tax and fidelity.
And I think to their credit, people who believe in Bitcoin, true maximalists, people who believe fully in Bitcoin are like, yeah, that's better. Yeah. Like, don't engineer the economy. Like the example we just read of Rome, it's like, they did all this crazy stuff trying to engineer the economy, but people kept wildly speculating and ultimately led to X and Y. So I don't embrace total free market libertarianism myself, but I find a lot worthwhile about the idea of Bitcoin. And I think to criticize it from any sort of a standpoint that we need to like engineer economies, if you believe that, you're never going to like believe in cryptocurrencies. Yeah. There's like a fundamental disconnect. You either want engineered economies or you want some sort of amorphous, unengineered world money pool.
And that's what I appreciate about Seyfedin's book, which is that it is a very clear-eyed, if you believe in crypto, this is what you should believe in. Like, you should be an Austrian school economics person, and you should believe in anarcho-capitalism. You should believe that, and I don't know if he would say that this is true, but if he is consistent with his opinions, which I imagine he is, he's okay with the Uber coming along, you know?
Sure.
Like, he's okay with Michael Cohen getting completely wrecked. He doesn't think that the government should step in and save Michael Cohen, because Michael Cohen was propping up a New York City taxi licensing commission that was completely corrupt and was inefficient and was not servicing the number of people who needed it. And so when Uber comes along, it destroys it, you know? And that's a good thing. So that could happen to Bitcoin as well. I don't think he would say it would, because he would say that all the other coins are shit except for Bitcoin. And that's why Bitcoin is good.
I don't know what he thinks about other coins.
He calls them all shit coins.
But I find...
Like, that's what part of his Twitter persona. He's like, everything except Bitcoin is a shit coin. And people be like, what about Ethereum? And he'll say shit coin.
I mean, I sort of agree with him. What I noted, like, sometimes I wasn't sure if the things that Seyfedin was saying in this were like his ideas or his interpretation of Satoshi's ideas, because they're so close. But like the way you just described, you know, don't save the economy. The very first thing we know about Satoshi is that Bitcoin is directly inspired by the like banking bailout. It's like one of the only things we sort of know is that that was what he was thinking about when he launched Bitcoin. So I think if you look at that as the foundational myth of the Bitcoin narrative, we're driving towards some point where economies can no longer be bailed out because they are not under the control of governments. If you look at, you know, if you're a true Bitcoin maximalist.
Yeah.
I also think he makes an argument, I'm wondering what you think about this, that there's no real halfway with Bitcoin, like that the only path for Bitcoin is maximalism at some point.
Yeah, and I actually found that part of his book to be the most convincing.
Yeah.
Was that this thing only really will get to its full potential if it becomes the standard for the world. And I actually...
I didn't even think about the title until you like said that.
Yeah,
that
I have real problems with that pragmatically, but I actually think I might agree with it in a theoretical idea where I don't even know which way I would go, but I would say, yeah, if it's going to work, it needs to be... full on. It can't be this thing that only certain people use and is like an interesting idea and is only used for certain types of transactions. It needs to be like the store of value for everything.
Yeah.
And that's where the idea of the deflationary currency really needs to be. It needs to be the only deflationary currency. And like, I actually found that to be quite convincing.
It made me think about like what the last project that I heard about that's goal was the whole world, which is probably Facebook. If you invested in Facebook when it was already being publicly traded, you're basically like, what's the ceiling? Well, the ceiling is the entire world.
Yeah.
And at a certain point, as enough people invest in these things, like an investor in Facebook, if you're buying Facebook, you know, as it's already like up there, you're basically like, I think it will. And at a certain point, if you're buying Bitcoin, you have to believe in a Bitcoin maximalism. Like, as Bitcoin gets up over $20, $50, $100,000, if you're still buying then, the only way you're going to win is if Bitcoin maximalism takes over the world.
Well, yeah, because the price, it's even at 10,000 right now or whatever, it's at 9,000.
Yeah.
That potential is baked into the price right now. It's not like people think that a Bitcoin is actually worth $9,000 right now. They're baking in the idea that perhaps this is going to take over the world. He actually brings Facebook up in the book in a way where he says that, look, these types of ideas have worked in technology where, like, look, Facebook became the standard because it allowed for certain features. And as the network grew in after a certain size, all other competition became impossible. So, like, Google could create Orkut or Google Plus, it didn't matter. You know, like things like MySpace fell off, obviously. Massive, massive companies could try and make social networks, but it wouldn't matter because Facebook had gotten a certain amount of share in which there was no feature that you could add could actually replicate the features that happen when you have a ton of people on it, right?
Yes.
And he says that for Bitcoin to work, it needs to reach that point. He seems to believe that it is close to that right now.
Not just in value, but in terms of the nodes of the network and the connectivity.
The number of people who use it.
People using it to make transactions.
And that's why he thinks everything else is a shitcoin, that is a distraction from this idea that Bitcoin will take over in the way that Facebook has taken over.
I think that's a provocative argument, but let me push back on one of those points because I'm curious what you think. So you said that that's already cooked into the 10,000-ish price.
Yeah, of course. Yeah, yeah.
But when I read this history of money that Amos lays out in this book, we already know how much money is, like all the gold in the world is worth based on the current value of gold. And gold is the jump before Bitcoin. For Bitcoin to even pass gold, and he is making the argument that Bitcoin is like a vastly superior technology to gold, Bitcoin would be hundreds of fold more valuable than it is now.
Oh, yeah, right? Sure. But
So that the possibility of that is cooked into the price. But you would also say, if Bitcoin even vaguely makes good on the possibilities,
it'll be worth millions of dollars.
Okay, that was my rate. I was like, if you believe this book is the future, Bitcoin is worth over $1 million.
I mean, look at the price of Amazon stock right now, right?
Sure.
Like it's $1,600 a share.
Would have been unthinkable 5 years ago.
But part of that $1,600 is people speculating on the future, and that's part of the price. It's baked in the idea that like everything we buy,
the entire retail profit.
Yeah, and
of
they've
America.
Like taken over like large states, you know, which is what they're trying to do. That's baked into the $1,600 price. It's not like the actual business right now is worth whatever it is at $1,600 a share. The speculation is baked in. So with Bitcoin, you know, some of the criticism of it is that there is no actual fundamental, that the whole thing is baked in potential, which, you know, I'm sure Saifedean would disagree with, but which I find a little bit more convincing.
I think that the current price compensates for a lot of scenarios that are not Bitcoin maximalism, that are like, hey, Bitcoin gets so big, it's as big as the 15th largest economy or something like that. But it does not totally take over in that kind of way. Did the book make you want to buy Bitcoin?
Yeah, it did. And, you know, I think that I think we should go over one example that he brings up of why Bitcoin is good. And this is about Bitcoin's potential to influence governments, right?
Yeah.
That right now what we have is a veil between the government and the people, so that even when you have the gold standard and you have dollars that are pegged to the gold standard, like we can't peer into Fort Knox or walk in there with like a little scale or something like that and make sure that the amount of gold that they say they have is what they actually have.
Similar to my like arguments about bad actors on blockchains, which is like, yes, all of this works if you assume that people are not lying. But in a non-public blockchain, there is a certain trust that people are not lying, just like there would be in Fort Knox there.
Yeah, and he is essentially saying that when you have this radical transparency of money, that people will be, and when money is scarce, that people are actually much more prudent about how they spend money. And so his argument is that this will affect everything. So people will actually become more engaged in how the government spends money because they don't assume that there is an endless amount of it. And this I actually find somewhat convincing because, like, do you know what the federal deficit is right now?
I would not try to say it on air.
Do you have any idea how the federal deficit affects the government functions?
Generally, like, debt ceiling shutdowns is the main time I hear about it.
Nobody knows any of this, right?
Yeah.
Like, nobody actually knows how much money the United States government has. Nobody actually understands how it's, every once in a while, like USA Today will like make a cool infographic that shows how much of its military spending or whatever. But that's it, you know? And he says that if money is scarce, if it is on the blockchain, if it is very transparent, then the government will be forced into only making prudent decisions. He says that that will actually cut down military spending, that because while people will feel a certain need to do things like, you know, improve healthcare or whatever like that, what they won't do is sort of say, hey, we should fund this like small operation in Yemen, and we should fund this small operation in the Mindanao in the Philippines, and this one in the Sudan, that once people are actually aware of how much money is being spent on those types of things, that they will backlash and that they will vote people out of office. Do you find that convincing?
I think the government stuff is the final leap where I don't quite understand how Bitcoin works as a governmental currency.
Well, it would just be like the money that everybody uses around the world, right?
Right. So the U.S. Federal Reserve would be
Bitcoin.
10 million Bitcoin.
That would be a lot.
If we're doing really well. That's an American maximalist scenario.
Yeah, exactly. That's Aaron the Imperialist talking.
You know, Trumplandia, of course.
I mean, I think that it's more just what happens psychologically when money is sort of scarce and transparent is what he's talking about.
Right.
And
no,
that people would really track it a lot harder and that they would be more interested in short-term personal outcomes instead of these sort of abstract campaigns.
Right.
That cost them personally money, and that they would be more prone to push for things like healthcare or, you know, like Social Security than they would be to push for like a campaign in Yemen that they don't know why we're doing it.
Right. And the counter argument to all this would be sort of the Surowiecki argument that we talked about, that a Bitcoin economy would be unkind, perhaps even cruel.
Yeah.
And all the engineering that is done on the economy would be undone to disastrous effects for human life,
like,
in America.
95% of the people in America would be too poor to even get themselves to a polling station is the alternative.
Yeah, and I feel like there's usually a lot of guns in these scenarios. Like when I like really start playing them out in my mind, I'm like, if I believe in that world, I think I'm also long on gun stocks.
Yeah. All right, well, is that a good place to end?
Yeah, that's not a world I want to live in. But I'd still buy some Bitcoin.
Yeah. Yes, the answer is always we should buy Bitcoin.
Okay, so Jay, this was great. I enjoyed talking about this book with you.
Yeah.
We're going to get you a real copy of the book for next week.
I've already ordered it.
And people at home, order the book. We kind of did like the first couple chapters, a little bit of maybe chapter three there. So four through seven, we'll try and do next week. Let us know if you are listening and you have questions in your reading, comments. We'd love to hear from you. We're going to talk to the author of this book, Safedin Ammous, on the last episode. So listen along, catch up as you can, and we'll be there in a few weeks. Yeah, thanks for listening. You got anything you want to talk about, Jay? Anything you want to promo?
No.
Push that show, man.
What show?
Oh, you know.
Coin Talk?
Coin Dads, but that's right. That's what I'm talking about.
This episode of Coin Talk was taped Wednesday, May 9th at 4 p.m. Eastern Standard Time. The Bitcoin price index was $9,273.
This show is brought to you in partnership with Medium. Medium makes it easy to read all of the new writing about crypto at me.dm/crypto. You can, of course, find every episode of this show at medium.com/cointalk. That includes transcripts for those who need to catch up quickly, read along. We're doing again chapters 4 through 7 next week. If you want to get in touch with a question, it's hi@cointalk.show. Talk to you soon.